It's a wonderful name. Why do you call it the Impossible Institute?
Well, one of the things that we work on is a methodology where we start with an impossible question. So an impossible question might be, we were working with a big bank in Australia, and they said to us, look, we're such a big organization, we have so many customers that when you call the bank, there's almost zero chance of not being put on hold. And so the impossible question we asked was, what if people wanted to be put on hold? So what we ended up doing was we started talking to one of the music labels in Australia and said, let's get all of your artists to record unplugged versions of their song, and the only place anyone can ever hear them is the on-hold music for this big bank. You know, so can you imagine being taken off hold and going, no, put me back on hold. I want to hear the rest of that song. So that's really what, you know, formed the basis of the name, was this methodology of what if we started with an impossible question and work from there? And I think one of the things that that we strike in innovation, particularly in large organizations, is we've spent 50 years beating the individuality out of our people. You know, we've very much built cultures of replaceable cogs. And I think that's an issue. I mean, I think that was a terrific thing, you know, post-industrial revolution, when we had very, we wanted very formulaic products of a certain, you know, reasonably low standard. But in the modern economy, where we can have far more personalized products, where we can have far more personalized service, a capacity to be more individual in the way that we work is actually increasingly important. It's just that we've forgotten how to do that in a corporate context. So a lot of what we do is going inside big corporations and, you know, helping people who've spent, you know, 10, 20, 30 years learning how to be an employee, helping them to think more like an entrepreneur. You know, what... In some ways, if you think about the traditional SWOT analysis, you know, the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats, in some ways that methodology is outdated, you know, because oftentimes, you know, your strengths are category generic, and actually that makes them a weakness, because typically if you're good at it, well, your competitors are probably good at it as well, whereas your weaknesses are actually opportunities, you know, because usually our weaknesses or our foibles are personal to us and can actually be turned into something interesting. But the other thing that's, you know, probably more important than that is we want to create cultures where the biggest threat to your business is actually coming from the inside. In other words, where you're hacking the future of your own business. You're reinventing the future of your category before someone else does. And that's not the way we typically think as employees. You know, this idea that we should be the biggest threat to our business, you know, typically we don't think that way, because we're in a very defensive mode. We're actually trying to shore up, you know, whatever we've got. Whereas, you know, someone who's got a more entrepreneurial mindset doesn't care about the status quo. You know, all they care about is driving success and building a business that's got a future. Employees typically care about not losing their job, which is different to how do we build a business? How do we reinvent the future of our industry or our category? And that requires a different mindset. And I think that the modern economy, which is, you know, we see an age of unprecedented change. You know, if you think about it, you know, just 20 years ago, my business partners and I were the only people we knew who had email addresses. Only people we knew who had email addresses, right? So the only people we could send email to was each other, right? And yet now it's ubiquitous. And you think, well, that's one generation's lifetime. And so if you think about how quick change is moving at the moment, you listen to someone like Ray Kurzweil, and, you know, he says we're living in an exponential age of change. In other words, the rate of acceleration of change is actually accelerating itself. And so this capacity to re-engineer ourselves, you know, the ability to unthink, rethink, and outthink people is actually the core skill. It's not about the capacities you've learned in your education. It's actually about your capacity to reinvent yourself consistently. And that's more of a creative methodology. You know, if you think about it, you know, people who are more activated in creative thinking, they're actually really comfortable with change. Actually, they like change. Whereas most of us find change threatening. And in fact, it's you know, there's an evolutionary basis to that. You know, change, whether it be in the environment, whether it be, you know, foreign invaders, you know, change hasn't always been good to us in human history. And we tend to see change as threatening. And I think that we're moving into an age where we need to reframe the way we look at change, and even the way that we approach change. I think it needs to be more than just a case of well, let's look to where the competition is going and either acquire someone smaller than us or just imitate.
I would argue that change generally is dangerous. There is very rare, you know, if you take 100 changes, probably 80% will be negative just for simple disruption of the way you're operating and having to adapt.
Oh, absolutely. Having said that, I think we're exposed to more change than ever before, and certainly at a faster rate, which means that a capacity to, you know, what we would say is it's better to drive change than to manage it. You know, it's better to be the disruptor than it is to be the disrupted. But I don't think you get to choose to not be on that curve. I think everyone's on the disruption curve, and it's a case of whether you're acting in change or you're reacting as a result of change.
How do you take organizations or teams or people that have a bureaucratic mentality, which is, you know, this is the way we've always done it, and why take any chances to change, and make them say, wow, there is an opportunity? How do you give them that self-confidence, or is that even what you want to have?
No, I think that's a very good way of describing it, this idea of giving them self-confidence, because I think innovation and an appetite for change is a leadership skill. I've heard employees described, perhaps a little unfairly, as people looking to do the least possible amount of work without getting fired. And I think that there's an element of truth in that. But I think that, certainly this idea of looking to maintain status quo makes sense to an employee. You know, if I'm required to change as little as possible, then I certainly have a feeling of competence in the work that I'm doing and a feeling of accomplishment. However, I think that there's a responsibility in leadership to make challenging process and challenging the status quo okay, because very few people will challenge an environment where there isn't permission from leadership to bring that kind of thinking to the table. You know, very few people will volunteer to rock the boat. The successful leaders today are the ones who can create a culture where challenging process and systems and the way things have always been done is actually critically important. And that can be uncomfortable, you know, particularly for a leader, to have their decision-making questioned or to have that challenged. And I think, one of the issues that we run into in large organizations is a homogeneity of thinking. In other words, you'll end up with executives that hire versions of themselves. You know, they'll hire for personality traits that they admire because that's who they are. And, you know, we'd suggest that a better tactic is actually to hire people who are, you know, actually a little bit irritating. You know, people who have a capacity to challenge our worldview, to offer a point of view that we may not have access to. One of the issues we run into is that particularly with really, really smart people, is they end up with contextual blindness. In other words, they know so much about the way things should be done that they can't see how things might be done. And that becomes a real problem. So an example of that is the Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. They had a critical error rate transferring people from the operating theatre to the recovery ward. And they couldn't figure out how to solve the problem. So in the end, they called in an outsider, someone who had no medical experience, no idea of how to run an operation, no idea of how a hospital should run. He just happened to be the pit crew boss from Ferrari's Formula One racing team. What he was an expert in was highly accurate, fast transitions. And he was actually able to look at their process, how they transferred from operating theatres to recovery ward, in a way that was objective. He didn't have contextual blindness. He could see a solution that they couldn't see because they knew too much. And that's what we're looking to put in our teams, is not just diversity of gender or ethnicity. It's about how do we make sure that there's a cognitive diversity in our teams as well. You know, a different methodology of thinking that challenges just one worldview.
How would this be relevant to me? How do I make it work for me?
That's a really good question. And one of the issues that small business has is you end up wearing so many hats. You know, you're the CEO, you're the head of human resources, you're the head of marketing, you're the head of sales. And typically what happens is you lack some of the challenge you might get from an executive team. You know, you don't have someone questioning your judgment because it's you. And I think one of the opportunities is to actively look outside your category, right? And because I think what happens is we know so much about our industry or our business, our service, our product, that we become myopic in the way that we view the world. And yet if you have a look at the trademark office in the United States and you have a look at the most successful trademarks, the most successful patents that have been registered over the past 50, 100 years, they're typically not out-of-the-blue technologies. They're usually two hitherto disconnected technologies that have been joined together in a new and interesting way. I'll give you an example of that. In Australia, there's a bedding company. They make pillows called Tontine. And a couple of years ago, they started putting use-by dates on their pillows. Now, I've had use-by dates on tins of beans in FMCG for years. So it's not new technology, right? And we've also had the problem with bedding being, you know, contaminated with bacteria and this ecosystem that grows in our pillows. And we're all looking at our pillows thinking, just how yellow does it have to get before I change it, right? But now I don't have to think about it. I've got a use-by date that tells me when to change it. Not new technology. What it required, though, was someone looking outside their business, their industry, for an idea that solved a problem that they already had. So I think that's what small business can do, is one of the advantages that small business has is they can be more reactive, they can be more nimble, they can move on the dime, you know, a lot more easily than a large organization. However, they also need to be open to looking outside their sphere of experience for opportunities and actually for ideas. So I think that one of the issues is we go to trade shows of our own industry and we mix with our peers, when actually it's just as useful to go to a trade show of something we have no connection to whatsoever, just because it challenges our thinking.
What are some concrete action steps that I should take? For example, you say go to conferences of other industries, talk to other people. What would you say?
Okay. I think the most critical thing that any business can do is to, you know, we would say start with who rather than why or how or what. In other words, the more you know about your customer, the better you are able to serve them. Because typically, you know, we'll work with an industry, you know, or a business, and we'll say to them, tell us about your product or your service. And they'll talk to us for hours. You know, they'll go into the detail, the minutiae. And we say, okay, now tell us about your customer. And we get these pat generic responses. And it's actually the depth of understanding you have for your customer that actually is about how you connect with customers. So an example of that, a small business example. We were working with an entrepreneur, and we said, so what's your business? And she said, I make food for kids with allergies. We said, okay. And she said, it's parents. We said, great. Be more specific. Who is it? She said, it's mum. Okay, be more specific. Who is it? And she said, it's mum with a kid with an allergy. And she kind of struggled to go any further than that. And we said, okay, well, what's mum really care about? Oh, she wants food for her kids because the kids have allergies. And I'm like, well, no. What kind of food do you sell the most of? What kind of food is it? And she said, well, actually, the food we sell the most of is the treat food. It's the party food. And we said, do you imagine that the mother of a child with an allergy is afraid that her child is not going to have a normal childhood? That she's going to be the outsider that shows up at the party and can't have any of the fun food? Do you think that might be what's really driving mum? And she said, oh my God, you're absolutely right. That's what they come in. And we said, so you're not in the business of selling food for kids with allergies. You're in the business of helping a mum whose child has an allergy give that child a normal childhood. Now, can you hear how that's a more emotional, more compelling argument to make for a business, and how actually that should drive the new products that she brings to marketplace, how she frames them for her customers, the innovation that she drives. You know, understanding your business in terms of customer framing versus product framing, I think is the most important thing any business, regardless of size, can do. And it's probably the thing that people in all businesses do the worst. You know, we become product-obsessed or service-obsessed. We're obsessed with our job, when actually if we flip that and we spend more time digging into what's going on for the customer, that transforms our business in every way. Creativity isn't a talent. It's a discipline. It's a learned skill. You know, it's one of those things that I think, you know, I grew up in a very musical family. My mother was a child prodigy. You know, she won the National Estefan in Australia when she was 12 or 13. And so in my family, you know, before you started school, everyone started piano lessons. I just assumed that's what everyone did. And so by the time I made it to, you know, my fifth or sixth year at school, I was quite an accomplished pianist. And people would always say to me, oh, you're so lucky that you inherited your mum's talent. You're so lucky. And I said, you know what? She gets me up at 5 a.m. every morning and makes me do an hour's piano practice. I earned this, right? And the truth is, it's the same with creativity. You know, it's a conditioning that you have to your brain. It's a conditioning that you have that allows you to see things from perspectives other than the automatic, other than the expected. So I think that's a critical thing that we need to, but you know, even in schools, you know, we don't, you know, we teach kids critical thinking, but we also need to give them creative thinking. Because if you think about the kind of skills, you know, children and businesses are going to need going forward, they need critical thinking. Absolutely, it's important. They need creative thinking, but they also need to understand how to communicate, how to engage people. And that's critical in any facet of business, particularly if you want to be a leader.